Did you know there's an online cannabis company that ships federally legal THC right to your door? And they found a way to combine THC with carefully selected functional ingredients to create gummies, baked goods, and flower for whatever type of buzz you'd want. I'm talking about Mood.com. They have an incredible line of cannabis gummies, and you get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code SPECIALISTS with an S on the end. This isn't some rinky-dink discount of 5 or 10%. This is 20% off your first order. Forget one-size-fits-all supplements that only get you high. Mood's functional gummies are optimized to kick in as little as 15 minutes and take you to the mood you're looking for. My favorite are the Sleepy Time Advanced gummies. That's right, those are for sleepy time. You know when you just can't fall asleep? Take these and they'll put you right in the mood. Beyond gummies, Mood also has a selection of flower, pre-rolls, bakery treats, and beverages. Listen, you can find gummies to just get you high pretty much everywhere these days. But Mood's functional gummies combine premium, federally legal THC with targeted botanicals to help you get into the perfect mood, usually in as little as 15 minutes. And everything ships discreetly right to your door. No dispensary lines, no awkward conversations, just better days and nights delivered to your doorstep. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with promo code SPECIALISTS with an S on the end. So head to Mood.com, find the functional gummy that matches exactly what you're looking for, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. And don't forget to use promo code SPECIALISTS when you check out to save 20% on your first order. Try it today at mood.com.
Movie buff specialist Phil and John are back, and welcome to episode number 80. I can't believe we're here. We are at number 21. After this, we will only have 20 episodes remaining. It's kind of unreal to think that we've actually come this far. And don't worry, next week we're talking End of Evangelion, and you have plenty of time to watch the show because John's not actually here next week. So it's going to be in 2 weeks. That's the fun part. So go ahead and make sure you get the show in and then watch the movie because I sure still need to finish the show. But anyway, tonight we are talking about A Ghost Story from 2017 and Lawrence of Arabia from 1962. Probably the best podcast to showcase why we started doing this in the first place and why we just love doing this podcast and just love movies in general. We have a 3 hour and 47 minute epic shot on location in all the areas around Jordan and Egypt and Saudi Arabia and all that stuff, with nothing but real actors and nothing but real camels and nothing but real sand and nothing but real humans. And then we have A Ghost Story, which was shot in secret by three people who then also just pulled a bunch of random strangers in who weren't even really trained actors. So it couldn't get any different. And that's why I love doing this. Yeah. John, first time watching Lawrence of Arabia, because why would you watch a good movie before I bring it up? How was your four-hour journey?
We got into this awkward part where you had all these movies on your list, and I was like, is it better just the first time watch it for the podcast? And I decided yes. And I don't know why I never watched this movie before, because it's phenomenal. I understand why it gets the praise that it does. It is an excellent constructed film. Mm-hmm. And for it to have been made 60 years ago,
yeah,
it's just so impressive.
Yeah. All right, well, we're not starting with that though. We're starting with A Ghost Story. So of course, because A Ghost Story is a movie that came out a whole 5 years ago, and I guarantee you more people have heard of Lawrence of Arabia. So we're going to start with A Ghost Story, which is John's. Came out in 2017, directed by what, David Lowery, and it's Rooney Mara and Casey Affleck. John, give us the background on why you like this movie, and also maybe a little tidbits on how this movie came to be.
Well, it's really hard to like sum up exactly why I love this movie. I'm going to try my best, but a lot of it comes down to the fact that David Lowery kind of frames this film where you have absolutely no idea what this movie is at any point throughout the movie. You hear the title, A Ghost Story. Okay. Mm-hmm. It's some like haunted house horror movie, maybe. And the film starts that way. It feels like a horror movie for the first like 5 minutes of this film. And then you progress a little further and you find out it's actually an existential horror movie. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, Casey Affleck gets up with the sheet over him and he's like the sheet ghost. And you're like, okay, is this a comedy now? And it's no, this is one of the most depressing movies ever made. And the way that Lowry is able to just thread the needle between all these different tropes and still make this incredibly heavy hitting film that at once, as soon as you think you have a grasp of what this film's doing, it does something completely different and just becomes even better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The first time I saw the trailer for this, I was living in LA and I remember watching the trailer and being like, wow, that looks cool. And like, it was shot all like, you know, what the different aspect ratio and all of that. And I was, you know, how cheesy is that going to be? How pretentious is it going to be? I was living in North Hollywood at the time, which is one of the most pretentious parts of Los Angeles. So that didn't help either. But so I was just like, all right, like, what is this movie really going to be? And I was all about it and I went and saw it and I just remember being like, wow, that is a heavy, heavy, heavy movie. And I knew it wasn't going to be a horror movie just based on reading about it and everything like that. I knew it was more of this like existential looking at humanity and all of that. And I think this is a damn near perfect movie from beginning to end. Like this is a 4-star movie to me, all of that fun stuff. But what always stops me from bumping this into my top 100 or even a consideration is maybe like the first half hour or so. And I think the first half hour or so are great, but the last 40 minutes of this movie just wreck me every time. And I almost get frustrated when I watch, this is like the fourth or fifth time I've watched this movie. I almost get frustrated that it doesn't get there sooner, even though I'm totally fine with like an act one. I love the meditation on life that this movie is. And I love like the way it just disregards time and any type of linearity, whatever the word would be for that. But I just love that it just disregards all of this stuff to make this movie. I think it's just a really awesome thing. And I don't know how clear I'm coming through, but hopefully I'm coming through okay.
Yeah. I mean, I'm still hearing you. So,
okay, good. Okay.
Hopefully everyone else is too. But that's exactly what it is. When I sat down and watched it this week, I forgot how far into the movie we get before Casey Affleck actually dies.
Yeah.
And that there is all this setup, but that setup is so important as well because you get this, I mean, you get this, I love the fact that this movie starts with laughter. That it starts with them laughing on the couch together. It looks like they're happy. And they're really at the root of it. They're having this argument about whether or not they should leave this very not great house that they're living in. And as we progress, we kind of get these horror elements. We get that moment of Casey Affleck seeing the prismatic light on the wall. And then when you get to that moment again later and you realize he's looking at himself.
Yeah.
It's mind-boggling what David Lowry was able to do with this film, with such a simple film. And the way that he makes you just think about absolutely everything. The fact of like, okay, what is this relationship? What does everything mean between like these characters C and M? What is life? What is death? What is time? Like, David Lowry holds no punches with this film at all when it comes to the topics he wants to address.
Yeah, and he avoids the cliches that a lot of movies in this genre fall into, right? Like so often we see these movies get into all of those big questions and then they have to force the story in. Rooney Mara disappears for about 40 minutes of this movie and Casey Affleck's walking around in a sheet. And those are our protagonists for this film, but they're gone now. They're hidden and they're gone. And I just think like when you start to look at what Lowry was able to pull off with this and the amount of effort and time and everything that went into constructing a script like this, to be able to make you feel so infinitely small, but also make you just like this is one of those movies that gives you like a hope for humanity because you sit down and you watch this and you say, how did somebody come up with this? And how did they pull this off? How did they execute this? And the part that always gets me is when Casey Affleck kills himself as a dead person, falls off the building, and we go from this gigantic metropolis where everything is now, and now he's back at a field, and we just have the family who's just doing whatever they can to survive in that same location. And this is the devastating stuff for me, right? Because I think about this stuff a lot. I mean, I don't know. I like to consider myself a deep thinker, even though half the time I don't think anymore, because once I start, I just pick this thing up and I'm like, all right, good. No more thoughts. But you think about that, right? Like, I'm in my house right now. I live in South Florida. South Florida used to be all Everglades and indigenous people. That's what it used to be. Who sat here first? Like when this was just grass, who sat here after that to determine that this was going to be a become a community? What was here before that? What's going to be here in, you know, 150 years when the Miami, West Palm Beach, Fort Lauderdale area is too big for its own good? And now they have to start making apartments all the way out here, like what they've done in Los Angeles. You know, Los Angeles is one of those cities for sure. You think about that. I lived in Los Angeles. You live in this place where, you know, back in the day, they were building these houses saying, wow, we're just going to like park on the street and do all that. Now you park on the street and you pretty much go to jail for a month and a half. So like, just when you start to think about that and the construct of things and what people are trying to accomplish and just where humanity has come from and where it's going, it's a reason why we both have 2001: A Space Odyssey so high on our lists and things like that. It's these movies that can make you think so deeply, but this is done still just all within the reality of these people. And it all takes place in this one location. It's this house that becomes this skyscraper that becomes, you know, that we see beforehand and after. And that's always the question, right? Like, we don't know what actually came before here because we don't have all that much recorded history. We like to pretend we do. We don't have that much recorded history and we don't know what's going to come in the next 100 years and we're not going to be here to see it. And that is the exciting part about a movie like A Ghost Story. And so rarely is this pulled off, but so often is it attempted. And so often does it fall flat on its face and just flat out fail.
Well, and it's just so hard. David Lowery kind of takes the genre that people have always kind of worked towards, like these themes that everyone kind of works towards. I mean, even when you're watching it, like it kind of has like tinges of like, we saw like Nolan do it kind of in like Interstellar and stuff, right?
Yeah.
But it doesn't have the same emotional impact that A Ghost Story has. And sure, part of that is to do with the emotional heaviness of the subject matter, mm-hmm. but more of it has to just do with the way that Lowery frames it in the film. Mm-hmm. And Lowery, the thing I commend David Lowery about the most is just his ability, his patience. His patience is phenomenal. And we saw it in this. We saw it in The Green Knight, too, which, you know, didn't get as much praise as A Ghost Story. But
mm-hmm. was I haven't seen The Green Knight, actually.
But he's so patient with everything he does. Even when we think about, like, that first scene of Rooney Mara dragging the trunk mm-hmm. out from the front there. And somebody would usually cut that at some point, right? A lesser director would cut that and like skip through it. But Lowery has us sit there and watch it. And it gives you this sense of terror and this tenseness that mm-hmm. that is so palpable because you have no idea where this movie's going at this point.
Yeah.
And she drags it out, puts it on the side of the road, goes back, and then we linger on the house. And it's framed again, like kind of like a haunted house at this point. It's like, what's going on here? What are we not seeing? And then he brings it back to pan over to Casey Affleck dead in a car accident.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
It's just that artistry that Lowery puts into this film that really elevates it for me and makes it so that it's just spectacular. I watched this movie and yeah, it makes me feel a whole lot of emotions. It makes me feel, like you said, so infinitesimal compared to the great spans of the universe. A lot of that has to do with the party scene, which we're going to get to eventually.
Oh, yeah. The party scene is freaking unbelievable.
Yeah. But a lot of it is also just like the sense of time and like the erasure of time and this idea of like, what are we after we die? Like, how do we leave this lasting legacy? And then you have it anchored around two phenomenal performances. Like,
yeah.
First off, Casey Affleck has a sheet on his head for the like majority.
Well, and this was the first movie that he did after Manchester by the Sea, right? Wasn't this his first movie after?
Yeah, they both came out 2017, right? No.
Well, they both came out the same year, but I think this came out right after Manchester by the Sea. So like he's about to win an Oscar.
Yeah.
And he makes a movie where he just walks around with a sheet on his head.
And it's incredible because, I mean, if you see Casey Affleck in a movie, you just know you're going to be depressed because Manchester by the Sea, also incredibly depressing. And Casey Affleck just pulls it off. But it's the intentionality in his movements while he has the shoot on his head. There's the scene right as Rooney Mara's character leaves the house for good and he's looking out the window. And then he just like jolts over to the door frame where she's put this piece of paper. It's so terrifying. It's just such a shocking movement. And then there's just this subtlety of him raising his hand up to scratch away at the paint.
Yeah.
It's incredible what he's able to do in this film without, like, we've taken away his voice, but you've also taken away facial expression, which is one of the biggest tools an actor has. And he still nails it. You know every single emotion that's happening. You understand when he's getting angry later on in the film. And you understand, like, this frustration he has. It's phenomenal what he can do just by, like, essentially changing his posture.
Is it funny that we're about to talk about Casey Affleck again the next time we do this because he's in Good Will Hunting for, like, 5 minutes?
I mean...
I just think it's... I think it's interesting to see where he came from, right? Yeah. Like 1997, he's Ben Affleck's kid brother. 2007, he's in Gone Baby Gone.
Yeah.
10 years after that, he's winning an Oscar and he's in A Ghost Story.
Yeah.
It's very interesting when you think about the trajectory of Casey Affleck. But yeah, I agree. And so one of the things that I really like about this movie, right, is there really is no beginning, middle, and end, right? Like we get the opening conversation. Yeah, it just keeps spinning on itself. And we get the conversation about, I used to leave behind these notes in my house, right? And like, how many times do we do this kind of stuff, right? Like you think about this all the time, or you do this or whatever, but like, you know, you give importance to things that really don't have importance. And because it's, how are you going to make this last? How are you going to make this more important than what it really is? You know, every time I go back to my parents' house, there's a different room in the house that has been changed. And I say to myself, man, I wish I would have taken a picture. But at the end of the day, who really cares if I take a picture or not? Like, I can remember what it was like. And who's going to care when I show them? Nobody's going to give a damn. So you sit there and things change and time goes. And he says, why do you do that? And she says, well, just, you know, I just want to leave a part of me behind. What did they say? Just stuff, you know, whatever. And this whole movie after he dies is based on what is his want?
Yeah.
What did he not accomplish as a living person that he wishes he would have? And ultimately, and we see it through the backstory and everything, he never actually knew and loved and was able to get where he wanted to with Rooney Mara throughout his life, right? And so, but he wanted to know her better and, you know, work and all that stuff just got in the way. So he never did. And so his reason for existing as the ghost self, the reason why he can't be at rest is because of this slip of paper. And when he finally is able to open that paper and look at it, he immediately just disappears.
Mm-hmm.
And that is so powerful. Because what does that really mean and what does that accomplish and all that? But for Lowry to kind of base it all around, that was the opening conversation. And then this is what it is at the end and have it be that entire, his entire reason for continuing to exist and go through time and live in the zone because he can't get out of it. When we saw another one finally come to the realization that they're not coming home, they disappear because that was their, like, what are you learning? What realization do you need to come through? What do you need to do to finally put yourself at peace? And that's what Casey Affleck's ghost character needs to put himself at peace. It is so unreal. And every time I see that, I look forward to that scene so much when he finally pulls that out. It's brutal because earlier in the movie, when he's trying to pull it out, we get the bulldozer destroying the house.
Yeah. And that bulldozer, it feels so defeating. And then that's the first time we also see like the flower ghost disappear.
Yeah.
So it's really interesting seeing that contrast that David Lowry puts in here. It's also David Lowry's restraint to not show what's on the paper.
Oh, it's great.
Fantastic. Anything on that piece of paper probably ruins the movie. But not showing what's on that paper makes it so powerful because now all of a sudden David Lowry is saying, this isn't just what C needs. This is what the audience needs. Now this piece of paper represents everything the audience needs to be able to move on.
Yep. Yeah. No, I completely agree. If you tell us what's on that paper, that's a complete waste of our time. But So, you know, let's talk about this with the sorry, I'm gonna get comfortable and sitting in this chair for hours now. But let's talk about the destruction, right? So we have the bulldozer come in, destroys the house. Casey Affleck never wanted to leave the house because of the history they had, everything like that. He sees Rooney Mara moving on after he's gone, and then eventually Rooney Mara leaves the house, and now he's just trapped in this house, and who's gonna come next and who came before and all of that stuff that's going on. And then we see it get destroyed. And now this goes into the party scene, because that house, which he worked so hard to make matter, and the piano and it was left behind and this, that, and whatever, gets bulldozed so they can build a giant metropolis that ends up becoming this massive city. And, you know, it's so futuristic. We don't even know how far it is, but we know it's pretty far in the future. And he can't take it anymore. And he just jumps off, and now he's back to kind of square one. It's great. But it is the same thing that this bald man, whose name I will never look up. I don't want to know who plays him, because to me, he is that guy. I've never seen him in anything else. He gives one of the great one scene performances in the history of film. And I will not look up what his name is, but that dialogue scene, which is so pretentious and so over the top, is one of the best scenes in the last 20 years and maybe ever, but it's definitely one of the best scenes in the last 20 years, but I'll let you take it because obviously it's your favorite, but I just wanted to draw the parallel to the bulldozer from the house.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And there is one famous person in this party scene. I don't know if you know this. Did you know Kesha is in this party scene?
Is she really?
She is the person. She's the person that the person is doing the card trick to.
Wow. I didn't realize that.
Yeah. So, but this scene, it's incredible. It's just this idea of, we all know this guy, this pretentious guy who drops this philosophical thing. He's snooty. He's like, do you have God? No? Okay, then. Let's just talk about if we could make art without God. And he goes on about Beethoven and the making of Beethoven's Ninth, and how if he doesn't have God, he's making it for the people and everything. But that, you know, everything's built to be destroyed, essentially, right? Like we're all born to die.
Yeah.
And it's a long scene. It's so long. And it's just this one guy talking the entire time.
Cracking beer.
Like these little tiny interjections once in a while. But it's so profound. Just this idea of when he finally gets to the end of like civilization, he's like, you know, one day maybe one person just hums that familiar melody, starts singing Beethoven's Ninth, and like that's like what goes on. It's just this idea of legacy and this idea of what do we become when we die, and who do we touch, and what memories have we put out into the world, and do we really die? And that's the big thing. When we have Casey Affleck standing there, we have existence of an afterlife in this film, pretty much contradicting everything this guy has to say.
Yeah.
But it's so profound and it's so deep, and it makes you think so hard about like, what are you doing? What are you going to leave behind when you do die?
Yeah. It's well, and I love it. I guess it's Kesha who says, well, my kids will remember me, or my friend, and they're going to die too. And when he just starts thinking, your kids are going to die, and your kids are going to die, and your kids are going to die. But that's the thing, right? Like you think about it, like, my dad will always talk about his grandfather. Oh, you know, my grandfather, he did this, he did that, whatever. He was a butcher, and he was right off the boat from Italy. So he's right off the boat from Italy, and he's a butcher. That's what I know about him. He died when I was 2 years old. I don't remember him. I've seen him in a home video. I've seen him in pictures, but I don't know who he is. So when my dad dies, who's going to remember him? And that's the crazy part, right? And that's why we do this crazy shit, though. And it's so accurate. Like, why do we make movies? Why do people make movies? They make movies because it is a form of immortality, essentially. But like this guy says, eventually it's not going to exist anymore. And you might think it's going to exist, but it's not. Something that you can't even comprehend is going to take over and just make it so that this doesn't matter. Us doing this podcast is so pointless, but we do it anyway because that's what you do. And, you know, they make that bit of music. You want to write a book? Great. It's going to get burned one day. It's not going to exist anymore one day. Like, everything will vanish. And that's where like this speech is so crazy, because I think too, this is in 2017 when there's all these conversations. How can we save the planet? How can we do this? How can we do that? Everybody feels like they are so important and they have such a purpose. And oh, if we just all work together, we'll make this happen. What's like, this is the mentality of what's going to be will be. And there's, you can try to stop it, but what is it? Like, there's so many layers to it, because it's also telling you keep doing and striving and dreaming and trying to achieve. But also, why are we beating our, why do we have sleepless nights?
And that's such an interesting thing about this scene, because it's kind of like this big culmination of millennials at the time, right? Like, as they're cusping, or they're starting to cross that threshold into their 30s, and they're kind of wondering what have they done in their life and everything. And historically, generations, when they get to that point, really delve into nihilism.
Yeah.
And we have that nihilism, but at the same time, there's so much hope in this speech of just like, just do it anyways. Like, who cares if you're doing it for yourself or not? Do it for whatever it takes to make this so that we have it.
Yeah. Yeah. And leave something behind. But it's that in like, right, every human being knows they're going to die. Even if we all think like, I'm not the one. I won't. Like, you know, I was thinking about the Blue Valentine speech. What are you going to, you're going to die? You're a sucker. I'm not going to die. I'm just not going to do it. And, you know, every human being, you know, knows it's coming. So why do we get up in the morning and go to work? Why do we buy a house? Why do we do this? Why do we do that? And this is the craziest part, though. Like, I can go on and get philosophical and nihilists. And I always just think of Above Montreal's song, Grandlandic Edit, where they say nihilists with good imaginations. It's like one of the funniest opening lines in a song ever. But like, when you think about all of that, right? Like, think about everything we've just talked about. This movie is 92 minutes long, was made in secret, was entirely shot in one house on one property in a field. And then, you know, the one hospital scene. What, how in the world does he pull this off? And that's just like what I get to. Think about all these types of movies that we've seen like this, right? Like, my favorite of this genre, and I will call it of the same genre, is Tree of Life.
Yeah.
It's that poetic meditation of life. But then look at how many times Terrence Malick failed to make that movie again after Tree of Life. He hasn't come close. And David Lowery hasn't made anything like this since this. Like, you know, like at least not in terms.
You can't. And,
like, this is a genre that's so hard to define, and it cracks me up when I see that this has like a 6.8 on IMDb, and I'm like, you peasants, you fools. But the depth that you pull out of a 92-minute movie that is two main characters and a man walking around with a sheet on his head,
yeah,
it makes me want to sit down and write a novel so that that freaking bald guy can burn it. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm ready to write it just so he can burn it, because at least for me, if I died before he burned it, I would feel like I did something that made me immortal.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you speak of this as like one of the greatest film scenes in the last 20 years. I think there's another point of contention for that title in this.
Better hurry up and get it in, John. We're running out of time.
In a 92-minute film, David Lowery dedicates 5.5 minutes to Rooney Mara eating a pie. Mm-hmm. And it is one of the most beautiful scenes of all time. Rooney Mara's performance in this, we talked about Casey Affleck and what he's done. Rooney Mara's performance in this is absolute perfection. She is so incredible in this film. And this scene is one of the best acted scenes of all time. You have Casey Affleck standing in the corner, just like there for 5 minutes.
Not moving. But you have
Rooney Mara going through all of these emotions and translating them as she sits on the floor and eats a pie.
Yeah.
It's incredible. And he dedicated 5 minutes of this 92 minutes to this scene.
Yeah. And the thing is, like, you know, a lot of people would just roll their eyes at that, right? Like, why do we have to watch her eat a pie for 5 minutes? But it gets into that level of, think about the speech that comes from Bald Man, right? His speech about nothing matters. We're all going to die. You're going to die, this, that. And yet that doesn't stop anybody from feeling devastated or struggling or having a hard time or anything like that. And a lot of times when you're feeling awful, you just eat yourself into oblivion. We see people with ice cream, you know, you always hear the ice cream and the tissues, yeah. right? You sit down and watch a Hallmark movie. And this is her eating a pie. And it just goes and goes. And I'm sitting there and I'm like, man, if I was Rooney Mara, I'd be vomiting too. But like she just keeps going. And we see as she eats more, the more upset she's getting. And she doesn't realize that he's standing right there. You know, like it is devastating. And it's so hard to watch. And yeah, just ask for a little patience, and it's something a little different, but it's so profound. It just gets its point across.
It's just that escalating, like, anger and being upset and sad and depression that Rooney Mara goes through. And it's every single forkful of pie she takes has a different emotion to it.
Mm-hmm.
It's yeah. incredible. It's a performance that shouldn't be able to be had. Like, you shouldn't be so invested in this, but you can't look away. You could never look away from this because it's so enthralling.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. 100% agree with that. Another thing, though, I want to give a shout out to, and it's actually, if I had to pick a second favorite scene, because I don't, you know, as much as I love the pie scene, it's not, you know, I'm not there with you, John, but I love the scene where she is listening to the song in the headphones. That is the part. See, so that's the point of the movie every time. Where it takes off for me. Up until that point, I am into it. I am enjoying it. I'm all about the meditation and everything. But the moment that they are showing, it shouldn't be this hard, blah, blah, blah. And he just takes the headphones and puts them on her head. And she's listening to the song when she really just wants to have this argument. He just doesn't care because he wants to do this. And they start playing. It's called I Get Overwhelmed by Dark Rooms. It is not Casey Affleck saying it. It is I Get Overwhelmed by Dark Rooms. It was in my top 100 that year on Spotify for sure. And then it cuts to her laying on the ground with the other headphones in, listening to the song. And that regret and appreciation in that one moment and her reaching her hand out and there's the ghost sheet. I mean, it's brutal. And when they play I Get Overwhelmed again later in the movie, when we're getting into like the final 5-10 minutes and it's going through the relationship and everything, and it's kind of spiraling towards him about the discovery of what's on that paper. Woo! That band doesn't have that many good songs. But if you want to listen to another one, Olga Korolenko by them, which is hilarious because, yes, that is the actress who was in Quantum of Solace. So very good song. But, yeah, that part, that scene just devastates me every time.
That scene's so good. I love, like, when the family moves into the house and then we start getting that disruption of time where we all of a sudden we understand that it is this idea that, like, an eternal being experiences decades in a blink of an eye, right?
Yeah.
And like, he just, David Lowery captures it so well with just transitioning from, like, you know, mom and the kids in the kitchen, and then all of a sudden mom at the piano with one of the kids, and it's just, he films it and frames it so well that you understand, oh, this is showing the passage of time through Casey Affleck's eyes.
Well, and the scene where the little girl dies.
Yeah.
Dead, skin and bones, nothing. Now he's looking at the floor of his house.
Yeah. It's so powerful. It's just incredible. This movie is so incredible. I love, like, there's so much symbolism in this. And we get, like, I love when Rooney Mara comes home with the guy and Casey Affleck gets mad and then the books fly off the bookshelf.
Yeah.
And we spent time trying to figure out why Loving the Time of Cholera is this book that is very predominantly there on the top.
John and I read that.
We did. It was long and it was arduous, but we read it. And I think really what it comes down to is this idea of, like, this waiting. And it's that waiting that the main character does for his true love and everything, and discovering, and the discovery that happens throughout it. Because in the end, one of my biggest complaints about that, sorry, spoilers for Loving the Time of Cholera. In the end, like, all the depressing stuff that happens throughout the book is kind of washed away by this euphoric ending where these two people are finally together. And, like, that's kind of what happens in this movie too.
It is, right? Like, they're both going to die and be back together is essentially the message we get from the end of this movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. John, we could talk about this for too long, but I got to cut you.
I know.
I got to cut you.
It's a phenomenal movie. I watched it this week. I'm like, does this movie move up into my top 20? Maybe, but I have a lot of really good movies ahead of it. It's going to be really interesting to see what happens when I finally rework my top 100.
Yeah, this is your Blue Valentine, right? Like my Blue Valentine, where I said this is probably a top tenner for me. Like now I'm really realizing. It's funny how your tastes change, right? Like I can't wait to get to Lost in Translation because I love Lost in Translation. That's in my top 10 or right outside my top 10, whatever it is. But I have a feeling Blue Valentine is in Lost in Translation be a lot closer to each other now just because they hit in different ways. But what was the best movie you watched since we last podcasted?
Well, I didn't actually watch that many. The theater at the local university showed The Room last week.
Mm-hmm. That's cheating. That's already in your top 100.
It is already in my top 100, so it is cheating, so it's not my answer. But, man, going to The Room in a theater is phenomenal. You know, people are throwing spoons all the time. People are yelling at the screen. It's just one of the most fun experiences you'll ever have watching that movie. But if we're talking about, like, a movie that I watched, it's got to be The Banshees of Inisherin.
We have the same one. We did it.
Yeah, we did it.
All right, so now we'll talk for the next half hour about Banshees of Inisherin instead of Lawrence of Arabia. I also have Banshees of Inisherin. I haven't seen that many movies from 2022. I normally wait until the Oscar stuff. There's just too many. Netflix saturated everything and just turned filmmaking into bullshit. But that's how I really feel. But Banshees of Inisherin was freaking great. And that movie, I saw you put it 3.5. What'd you say?
So speaking of depressing movies.
Oh, yeah. Well, speaking of small movies that are depressing, I mean, it's very similar to A Ghost Story in a lot of ways, except it's got Martin McDonagh's humor in it. But I saw you gave it 3.5. I gave it 4. I didn't know how I was going to feel about it, and it just kept going there. And I feel like I watched this 2 or 3 more times. Just throw it through. It's just keep getting better and better and better. I didn't know where it was going to go, but it just kept going. Weird movie.
Yeah, this is a movie that I expect on repeat watches to garner a higher review from me. 3.5 felt like the safe number to give it. And I think a lot of that is the fact that like it's really hard to figure out what to give this movie right after seeing it. You kind of have to digest.
The first half hour is so weird.
It's so weird to like pull up on it and like figure out what's going on. Barry Coogan's amazing in this film. Like,
who did you say?
Barry Coogan.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I mean, I will say that every single actor slash actress in this movie is Oscar worthy. Single one of them.
It's a great film. The fact that it's a Martin McDonagh film should mean that it's garnering some Oscar attention. I really hope it does because there were some fantastic performances. It was a great movie. It left you, again, kind of like happy and sad all at the same time. Mm-hmm. It's just a movie that really hits you emotionally.
We take this to our grave now.
Yeah,
we think like that just when that it's just like it is one of the best depictions of I don't feel like I'm achieving something and I'm also bored as hell is one of the best depictions of that. Like that is what that movie is. And just like how do you handle that when you start to realize you're bored and your life really doesn't have that much meaning?
Yeah.
And Irish People, man, it's probably the most Irish movie I've ever seen in my entire life. This puts Belfast to shame.
Yeah, oh yeah, definitely.
Yeah. I think it's going to get some Oscar, but I think Colin Farrell and Brendan Fraser are definitely the front runners right now for best actor. I'd love to see Brendan Gleeson win though because just be nice. Just at least nominate the damn guy. Like what does he have to do? Feckin' hell, right?
Yeah.
Feckin' hell. Anyway, all right, let's talk about Lawrence of Arabia, 1962, 3 hours and 47 minutes long. I'm sure some of you have heard of this movie. So this was an interesting one for me when it first came about. So I'm a huge fan of AFI and like their top 100 lists and everything like that. Whether not necessarily like what the lists are, but I was always obsessed with what are these 100 movies? Why are these 100 movies chosen? Like me and my dad would sit down and watch those specials and we'd go through them. And, you know, I always thought the Deer Hunter was the best. So when it would come in at like 55, I'm like, this list is bullshit. This is stupid. You get the One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest coming in the 30s. And then you're getting like, I don't know, Swing Time and, you know, all these other random, there's so many random ass movies in there. But all that being said, whenever we get to the top 10, it'd always be like Gone with the Wind. I had never seen it, but my dad was like, it's good. Whatever. And you'd get like, you know, The Graduate, Psycho, you know, all those movies that were in like the top 15, top 20 range. And you'd always get Lawrence of Arabia. And he had never seen it, and I had never seen it. And a lot of that had to do with the length. It's just so long. And he was always a big fan of The Bridge on the River Kwai, which I think is unbelievable, right outside my top 100. If I watch it on the right day, it probably jumps in. Like, it is such a great epic. But it was always one of those, just like, he never saw it, and he was a big movie fan, and then I never saw it because it was 4 hours long. And so he got it for me for Christmas once, because I just asked for it. I was like, I'm going to sit down and watch Lawrence of Arabia. It was like you at Satin Tango. And so I finally sit down and watch it, and about an hour into it, I was like, holy shit, this is one of those movies that actually lives up to the hype. Because so often you see on AFI, BFI, whatever it is, and I know you like the BFI list more, and that's fine, but I always think, like, when you start getting into top 10, top 20, you're automatically in overrated territory. Just because they're being rated there, and how are they going to live up to that hype? Casablanca can do it. In my opinion, The Godfather can do it, although I know for a lot of people that's an overrated movie. And Lawrence of Arabia did it. And when I was watching this, I was just so into the adventure aspect of this, but how compelling of a character T.E. Lawrence actually is. Such a great character, and David Lean taking us to this world that none of us have experienced, right? Like, even if you've been to the Sahara Desert and everything, you've never been there the way T.E. Lawrence goes, and you'll never go during the era that he went, during the British colonial times, and, like, you know, they're trying to colonize
World War One.
Thank you. But they're trying to colonize everything, and why are we fighting here? Why are we worried about the Bedouin and all the tribes when we should be worrying about what's going on the Western Front, right? Like, that's what's happening. And we're taken away from what at the this point was what the biggest event really in human history with the war. And we're taken to this quiet middle of nowhere, traveling across the desert. The landscapes are unreal. The sets, the explosions of the trains, and you know, just everything, every single thing. And it just, it blew me away. The next time I saw it, I was lucky enough to watch it in theaters when AMC was playing movies, just like, this was before pandemic, but they were playing like a lot of old classics on their anniversaries. And I guess it was like the 55th anniversary or something stupid. And like, if you get a chance, this, Steven Spielberg always said it, and Scorsese, they always would say, you got to see Lawrence of Arabia on the big screen. You say, okay, like, how, like, this, look at this TV. I mean, that's a pretty big freaking screen. Watching this movie on the big screen with a bunch of people who were there to watch Lawrence of Arabia, knowing the history of Lawrence. You're not watching with a normal audience that's going in to watch, like, The Banshees of Inisherin, who were, half the audience is going, what the F is this movie? You're watching this with people who are going to a 60-year-old movie because of what it is.
Yeah.
That was one of the best movie-going experience I ever had. And I just watched it again, and it just knocks it out of the park. It is the greatest. And I know The Godfather is kind of an epic, but I consider it a different kind of epic because of how it's filmed. This is the greatest epic ever made. And I really, from what I've seen, I don't think it's close, because it is just a straight epic, right? Like, the Lord of the Rings movies are epics, but they're fantasy movies. They're adventure movies. This is an epic. This was made. This is a biography about a guy who we don't know that much about. And it could have been so uninteresting, and it just knocks out of the park. I said to you, John, and I'll let you go, I promise. But I said to you, I texted you and said, it's funny the difference between favorite and best, because if somebody asked me what is the best movie ever made, I would say Lawrence of Arabia, but it comes in at number 21 for me.
Yeah. And like, this movie. So my experience with Lawrence of Arabia is I hadn't watched it until this week.
Yeah.
But like,
Shorter story.
I know that, like, my grandfather took my dad to see this movie in theaters. My dad, it was re-released in 88. In theaters in 88. It's when they did the remaster of it.
Okay.
And I don't know why 88 of all years, but that was
26th anniversary, bro.
My dad took my mom to go see it in theaters then. And my mom is a falls asleep during everything type of person. And she said she couldn't fall asleep during Lawrence of Arabia because of how enthralling it was. And I just watched it, and I feel exactly that. This film, it engages you immediately. The choice to start this film with T. E. Lawrence's funeral,
mm-hmm.
it's an interesting one because it's like, okay, what's going on? But it perfectly sets up everything that comes after it. I guess before it, because it's the past and everything. But point being, it sets everything up that you're going to see for the rest of the movie so that you know this character is not an infallible character. And that's so important in this type of movie. Like you said, there's no epic like it. That's because you can't make an epic after Lawrence of Arabia has been made.
Yeah. Yeah, and they tried. And like David Lean did Dr. Zhivago 3 years later. And in my opinion, Dr. Zhivago just doesn't come close. And like, I really like Dr. Zhivago, don't get me wrong. And I think David Lean is one of the best directors to ever live. But how, and we never will. So I'm gonna pose this as a rhetorical question, and know it's rhetorical. How do we ever have a movie like Lawrence of Arabia made again? Because that's what I want. Like, I know, like, we talk about The Mummy, the 1999 one, and we both love that movie. And obviously, that's not an epic, but that's kind of like one of those movies where it gets into, like, as Americans, and I include you in this one, John, I'm not just talking about us United States of Americans. I'm not talking about the authentic ones. I'm talking about all of North America. But as Americans, the Middle East is very scary and very interesting, right? Like, there's this feel of, like, there's this mystery that kind of makes it a little magical, but then there's also the other parts where you're like, okay, should I go live there? Like, do I want to go? Like, you know, like there's the negative and the positive.
Yeah.
And Lawrence of Arabia, and like the reason I bring up The Mummy is because like The Mummy gets into kind of the fun of that, right? Like all the fun stuff that's going on. Whereas Lawrence of Arabia gives such a matter of fact depiction of what actually took place to try to bring everybody together and eventually create what Saudi Arabia and Jordan and all that.
Yeah.
And like, I just find that material to be so fascinating. And I feel like nowadays when they try to make an epic, it's always got to be an epic that's based like, when I say epic, I say 3 hour movie, and it's a 3 hour movie that's always based in like the United States, or like it just bounces around between the US and Europe and all that. Like, how do you get this? Like, this movie just gives that feeling of, where are the people like T.E. Lawrence now? Where are those people who literally just wanted to go out and have adventure and see the world and get away from where they were? And rather than going and getting adventure by moving to Italy on the coast, they went to Saudi Arabia, they went to the Sahara Desert. Like, I just don't know how this movie, like, how do you ever make something that is even remotely close to this again? Because it's such a successful movie and it is so well, like, so well regarded and all that, but nobody even tries to make anything remotely close to Lawrence of Arabia again.
I mean, we've had some attempts, I think, but like, I mean, our most recent attempt is probably Dune, right?
But Dune's a sci-fi,
like... I know, and like, that's the thing, is like, you don't have this historical... I think we're getting to a point now where a lot of these like epic stories have been told, mm-hmm. and it's hard to retell them. I mean, we saw that push about like 10 years ago. Yeah, exactly. Right. Ben-Hur showed that you can't remake these movies.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, fun fact, original movies can happen too.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of it comes down to David Lean has such an appreciation for the vastness of this film. Yeah. It's an epic in length, but it's also an epic in scope. And that's a big thing that I think in a post-CGI world, we can never properly achieve.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, the shots of the sun rising over the desert and the sky at night and mm-hmm. like when he's shooting from so far away and you have the little like tent villages set up and just the massiveness of the desert. There is nothing. The scene where they're going across, I forget what it's called, but they're going across the whatever and the guy falls off and he has to go back for him. Like, it's just all so gigantic in scope. You're right. And like, you know, now they would say, okay, we don't need all those extras. We don't need all those camels. Go make that in post and we'll throw it together. It's just so authentic. And, you know, we go on and on about the scope, but we will also talk about the story. And I think some of the other things with this movie, because I think there's a lot of things that now in 2022, it's so easy to quickly criticize this movie for. And we were texting about it. And I feel that there are so many uneducated criticisms of this movie based on brownface or based on no women being in it and things like that, that just get so pushed over the important aspects of this movie, because this movie was made with such a careful appreciation for everything. And yeah, there's going to be some historical things because it was 1962, but you know, we'll talk about all that other stuff. So anyway, what else you got to say about the scope before I jump into my, my soapbox for real?
I was just in appreciation of it the entire film, right? Like, it's just, you feel like you are a part of this desert. I think David Lean makes the desert its own character. And I think it's one of those examples of, like, the setting as a character really, it's probably one of the best examples in film.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Like, you understand how intimidating it is. You understand how unforgiving it is. But you also understand what it provides at the same time and why these people are fighting for it.
Yeah.
And that's one of the big things. And that's part of the scope too, of we don't see films about empires dissolving.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we do sometimes, but they're always small located, right? When we see movies about the Roman Empire falling, it's usually in England, right? Where, like, the Roman Empire had its reach, but it wasn't really entrenched in England, right?
Yeah.
But here we see this is the fall of the Ottoman Empire. And I think a lot of this has to do with the fact that our 21st century education doesn't focus a lot on what the Ottoman Empire really was.
Yeah.
But this is a massive deal, especially for the British Empire that still exists at this time.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause you're going empire, and that's why they wanted to help them, you know, take it away from the Turks. That's what the whole point of, you know, the movie is. What'd you say?
It's just destabilization. We hear about it all the time.
Well, and it's funny because when you start to break down what is the story of this movie, it sounds kind of uninteresting.
It sounds bad.
It sounds boring, right? Like, and that's what I always thought was going to happen with this. So I always talk about, I don't like Gone with the Wind, and everyone, oh, cancel Gone with the Wind. I mean, there was that uproar to cancel Gone with the Wind. Like, people have just lost their freaking minds with canceling. They just want to cancel everything. Like, cancel yourself. Get out of here. But like, you cancel Gone with the Wind and whatever. But I watched Gone with the Wind. It's boring. Like, it's just so long and it's just tedious. And, like, Vivian Leigh is good and Clark Gable's good. But, like, oh, my God, it's so boring. And I watch Lawrence of Arabia and somehow they make this compelling. And so I want to jump into a couple things, because there's a lot of no-nos in this movie from the standpoint of 2022. So, you know, talking about this movie 60 years later, it feels good. The first no-no is there's not a single credited woman who acts in this film. Now, that is a gigantic no-no, right? However, there are two massive reasons why this is so important and why, yes, David Lean did this on purpose, okay? And here are those two reasons. Number one, the only women we see are dead, because it is showing that in this society and this culture that they had, it was the unforgiving, we are a patriarchy, we are male dominated, you will follow what the prince wants, and the women, you're just in the way, you're getting killed when we come and storm the place. They had no say in what was happening. You know, it's kind of like how all of the Arab nations didn't have a say in how they were being governed. The women really had no say. So that was number one. Number two, T.E. Lawrence is thought to either be asexual or gay. And in 1962, you didn't come out and say that somebody was asexual or gay. You just didn't do that. So there is no love interest in this movie, and there is no woman in this movie, because this is a war movie that is based around a man who had no interest in anything having to do with women. And not that I think he was disrespectful, but they say that if you go and read his papers, like his notes and things that he wrote to people, he states that he never had sexual relations or anything like that. And I think that is so powerful to this movie, because it shows why he is so obsessed with mm-hmm. what he is going after in this movie and how he can stay so driven and how he can want to make such a difference in this desert. So that's number one, John. What do you rebuttal? Go.
I don't have a rebuttal because in the end, you throw a love interest in the movie and this movie gets way worse.
It does. Like, it does.
I want women in film, but in this instance, like, what is your female character doing that is important in this film?
Exactly. Exactly. And I think it's an unbelievably ballsy move to not have any women in a movie, especially in 1960. I mean, this was the era of romances and love stories. Yeah. I mean, you got to think 3 years later, he makes Dr. Zhivago.
Zhivago.
Yeah, like that is a romance. Like that is a sweeping romance. Like, so that's the first one. And I just think that that is so important. And like, that's the understanding, right? Like that's where the understanding needs to come in. Number two, and John, you text me about it and I immediately just like punching you, but I know you were also just bringing it up. But the white savior thing, right? Like we've seen that storyline done to death. However, we both kind of talked about this a little bit. This story is so important because, and why it works and why this isn't your typical white savior is one, T. Lawrence doesn't feel like he belongs with the British. He does not feel that he fits at all with those people. He doesn't like the war. He doesn't agree with it. He doesn't like the whole, you know, we see him in the beginning with the stupid nonsense salutes and all. Like he thinks it's a joke. He thinks it's a sham. And so when he gets to go to Arabia, he is so in awe of this place. And he's honestly in awe of the people. And he wants so badly for them to do it themselves. He doesn't want to be. There are so many scenes where he starts to kind of become the God figure, you know, like the dances with wolves kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the scene on the train where he's kind of, you know, and the music is sweeping. It's so gorgeous and beautiful and everything's just amazing. But it's so much more than that, because then when it all starts to fall apart, we just see him breaking and the bloodlust and how he is just broken. And it's so much to do with himself as it is the environment. It's not just the environment. And they ended up being fine after he left. Like they ended up all dividing into their countries and the Ottoman Empire fell after T.E. Lawrence left. So there is that white savior thing, but it's not to the extent that we see it done being done just for the sake of like, I want it to be the white savior. Like, how's that sound?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of little things that are really important about it. Like you said, Lawrence's appreciation of everything in this film is huge. It's that adoration of just like understanding these people. It's stepping up to take that shot, right?
Yeah.
To kill the man so that these tribes aren't fighting with each other anymore. It's him in his like desert garb, just like flying around with a cape.
Yeah.
Like it's those little things that really give appreciation to this. And it's the ending of the film that really makes it different than your typical white savior film. Because he's integrated into the culture and everything and respected in the culture. But he also kind of betrays it at the end by betraying himself. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is, like, that's what happened with T.E. Lawrence.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and I think that's the, like, this movie is very historically accurate from all that. Like, so T.E. Lawrence really, well, I mean, this is the position he was put in. And it's funny because it takes, like, you know, the British are going to send in this man who's going to fix everything, and that's your white savior. And it spins it on its head by being like, and it's not working. It's not working. And it is working, but it's not. Like, it goes back and forth.
It's so important that the reason Lawrence is going there isn't to save everything. Mm-hmm. He isn't, like, the reason he is sent there is not to unite these people, which, I mean, granted, tends to be what the white savior trope really is. Mm-hmm. But he's not sent there to unite these people. He is sent there to dismantle the Ottoman Empire so that the British can have control of the Suez Canal.
Yes.
That's his entire mission.
Yeah.
And he just happens to liberate a people in the process.
Yeah. And this is not a defense of brown face, black face, any of that stuff. I mean, obviously this all happens in these older movies, and it was like a vaudeville trope for a lot and everything like that. But one of the things that comes out about this movie now is Alec Guinness is in brownface and Anthony Quinn is in brownface. And I do think why this movie stands the test of time and why those decisions, while obviously we look back now, we're like, why did they do that? There was so much reasoning behind it. And one was Peter O'Toole, this was his first movie, right? This was at a time when to make a big movie like this, you needed a star. And Alec Guinness was your star. And Alec Guinness was too old to play the role of T. Lawrence. So where was he going to go? So they have him play Prince Faisal. Now, Alec Guinness plays this role as respectfully as you can possibly play this role, right? Like that's just what, you know, I'm prefacing all of this right now. Anthony Quinn, same thing. It's not like they're playing caricatures. They're not Breakfast at Tiffany's-ing this thing. Mm-hmm. But I think what the most important overlooked aspect of this is while those two roles, you might sit there and say, oh God, like you got to be kidding me that they're in brownface. The fact that Omar Sharif has as big of a role in this film as he did in 1962. Remember, this came out the same year as To Kill a Mockingbird. So civil rights movements and all that stuff and like, you know, race and everything in America was not at a place where it should be in 1962. And Omar Sharif was able to come out as an Egyptian actor, get nominated for an Oscar, play a massive role in one of the biggest movies. Because really, Alec Guinness isn't in that much of the movie. Anthony Quinn's in a lot of it, but Alec Guinness isn't in that much of the movie at all. And play this part and play it with so much, again, there's no caricatures in this movie. And I think that's kind of what is so incredible about Lawrence of Arabia, because when you go back and you watch these movies from the 50s and the 60s and the 70s, you're always going to get these kind of like over the top characters. You're like, wow, that's kind of racist now, or that's kind of this, or that's kind of that. And this movie does such a good job of, they don't like, I love the fighting between Anthony Quinn and Omar Sharif throughout this movie and how they're not getting along, but it's not because they're uncivilized. It's because there's the one line in this movie, I think Omar Sharif says it, but he says that goes beyond this. They don't know why they're fighting, but that is, they have to fight. Yeah. Like it's blood or something like that. I forget exactly what it is, but there's a line in there about that. And I think that is what's so incredible. So Omar Sharif getting to play in this huge role at a time where David Lean could have just put all white actors in this movie in 1962 and nobody would have blinked an eye. And he put Omar Sharif in it, and all of the other actors that are in this movie, you know, that are like, you know, the people in the Bedouin tribe, they're all like from that area of the world. Yeah. So yeah, you have your Alec Guinness, because there was no way they were gonna make this movie without a star. And you have your Anthony Quinn, who has a big role. But for Omar, those things cannot overshadow the impact that Omar Sharif had by being able to be in this movie with as big of a role as he had, and to get nominated and lose. And I've never seen the movie that he lost. It was Ed Bergen, the guy who's in, or Ed Begley, the guy who's also in 12 Angry Men, plays the racist. He wins the Oscar this year, but I've never seen the movie that he was that he won for. But anyway, that's all just to say, like, there's so many things that you can say negatively about this movie, but there are purposes to a lot of those things that were for a greater good or were to make a bigger point, which I think is important and why this movie like just continues to just get praised as it moves further and further away from when it came out.
Yeah. And I mean, Omar Sharif is arguably like the cornerstone scene from this film too. Like the corner, like the knows from Lawrence of Arabia is Sharif coming to the well and like that long shot of the like approaching the well and everything, and he chews that scene up so well. It's incredible, just his performance here. And like, you know, he gets there, he shoots a guy, and then he just like owns the entire scene. It's a phenomenal scene, and it is the scene everyone talks about from this movie.
Yeah, when he's you are welcome. He was not welcome. And I mean, Omar Sharif kills it in this movie. Omar Sharif is so good in this movie. I mean, for him, the Oscar nomination that obviously comes out in Dr. Zhivago 3 years later, and I think he got I don't think he actually got nominated for that one, but either way, it's amazing what he was able to accomplish and just what this movie accomplishes overall, right? Because then you keep going back to like the stuff that's happening back at like base camp, essentially, whatever you want to call it. Claude Rains is phenomenal, as he always is. I freaking love Claude Rains. Claude Rains is like one of my favorite actors from that 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s. Arthur Kennedy, very good in this movie. But like all of that politicking that's going on that Lawrence and the tribesmen don't care about. They don't care. They just want what is theirs and they just want their own identity and they just want to live. And it's all the politicking that's going on behind the scenes and like, well, don't give them too much. Don't give them ammunition. Don't give them guns. If the line of this movie really is when Claude Rains says, if you give them artillery, you've now created an independent people. And that is such a powerful line. And again, why I think this movie stands the test of time so well, because it is showing how frowned upon or how negatively David Lean and people were looking at what the British were doing in this situation anyway. Like it is despicable half the time, or like, it's so aggressive and arrogant. That's the word, arrogant. And to have that line, if you give them artillery, you've created an independent people. We want to free you, but mainly to take down the Ottoman Empire, not to actually free you.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's very of the time, like, and not of like 62, but like that is what the turn of the century was like before, like as World War I's going on. We were still in the time of empires, and this was one of those things that really signaled the collapse of that.
Yeah, it is. I don't know, man. I go on and on and on and on about Lawrence Arabia. Like those were like the main talking points I wanted to hit because I just see that stuff all the time, and I'm just like, that's not.
What I mean, we also have the trope of the noble savage, which I think is executed. I mean, it's probably one of the best examples we get ever in this film, and because we get it from multiple characters, right? Where it's like the British look down so much on these Bedouin people, but like we see them, and we as a audience are able to connect with these characters. We don't understand them, and that's kind of where like this noble savagery comes around. This idea of like this person is from the East, so they're not as civilized as those in the West. And we get those scenes. We get the scene of like the tribes clashing and then having to kill someone like eye for an eye type deal. Or we get the scene with the photographer where he's talking about losing his humanity, which also to note, Lawrence losing his humanity after getting his picture taken there.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Brilliant subtlety.
Yeah.
But like we have those aspects of the noble savage, but these are characters we, like you said, we're not feeling stereotyped in these characters. We don't feel like these characters are being exploited or anything like that. We feel like these characters are characters unto themselves.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree with all that. And like, yeah, I think that Lawrence of Arabia, one of the most groundbreaking movies ever made, one of the most impressive movies ever made. Like I said, I think the best movie ever made. And it really, people can look back at anything. People are going to look back at us in 60 years and say, wow, people in 2022 were morons and they were doing some weird stuff. Like they're going to look back and there's going to be a lot of things that we think are so right now. And it always fun. I brought that up to one of my friends one time and they're like, nah, that won't be it. And I'm like, yeah, that's what they thought. Everybody always thinks they're doing the right thing. They always feel like they're fighting for the right cause, even those who are on the complete wrong side of things. Hitler thought he was on the right side of things. So all of that being said, I just feel like Lawrence of Arabia was moving the needle in the right direction in so many ways. And it's an unbelievable movie. And if you haven't watched other David Lean, so I know this is the only David Lean that we actually have in here. If you haven't seen Dr. Zhivago, if you haven't seen The Bridge on the River Kwai, if you haven't seen Brief Encounter, which is a really small movie, you know, all he has all these epics, and then he has Brief Encounter thrown in there. Watch those movies because they just really show like what filmmaking is and what it can be and the massive scale that you can accomplish. And why when I sit down and watch a Marvel movie, I don't, because like to me, what are they accomplishing? What is the massive scale? What is the excitement? What is new? What is groundbreaking? What is different? Nothing. Like that is why watch these older and just look at what they were doing, and with all the real people and all the real sets. I mean, in the Bridge on the River Kwai, they build a real freaking bridge and they blow up a real freaking bridge. There is no CGI. It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. So that's all. That's what I got. That's my Lawrence of Arabia spiel. Do you have anything else you want to say about Lawrence of Arabia?
It's a timeless classic. Like, it still stands the test of time. Watching it now in 2022, like, it's just, like you said, like, one of, if not the best movie ever made.
Yeah. Yeah. There you go. That's what I got. That's what we got. So we're not here next week because John thinks he can go on vacation. I didn't approve it. I don't know how he's doing it. It's not fair. We'll be back in 2 weeks. We're going to be talking End of Evangelion. We're actually doing a 1997 movie week, End of Evangelion and Good Will Hunting. So those are the two movies that we're doing. So End of Evangelion is obviously, what is it? The finale, kind of, essentially, like the remake.
Well,
of the
it's a little confusing. We can dive into that in 2 weeks.
Well, I just want to make sure that I know what the hell I'm watching. But there's a show that you should watch before you watch the movie. And I'm kind of getting through. It's an anime show. It's only one season. Thank God. Even though I actually like the show, I don't have the time to watch like 10 seasons of an anime show and then watch the movie.
Yeah.
So End of Evangelion and Good Will Hunting, which Good Will Hunting, all you have to do is sit down and watch the movie. That's all you have to do. Yep. You don't have to watch anything else. Sorry, everybody. But that's what we'll be doing in 2 weeks. So excited for that. We're hitting our top 20. John, actually, this is the time of the podcast where I say go from 30 to your 21. What was your 30? What was your 21? And talk about the movie.
I wasn't prepared for this. I need to get my list ready.
I'll do mine first. So my number 30 was Little Miss Sunshine, 29, The Secret in Their Eyes, the original, not the American bullshit. My 28 was Whiplash, 27, Magnolia, 26 was Space Odyssey, but I replaced it with Interstellar, 25, Planet of the Apes, 24, Swingers, 23, LA Confidential, 22, Blue Valentine, and 21 was Lawrence of Arabia.
And then for my, I had Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me. 29 was Moonrise Kingdom. 28 was Beauty and the Beast. 27, The Witch. 26, Arrival. 25, Birdman. 24, The Shining. 23, Zodiac. 22, The Third Man. And 21, A Ghost Story.
Yeah, so, and we watched The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus for Moonrise because I have Moonrise further up. So if you're looking for the Moonrise episode, it hasn't happened yet. If you're looking for The Witch episode, it's actually called The Witch. Don't let John tell you otherwise.
That's true.
Thank you all for listening. We will be back in 2 weeks discussing our 20th favorite movies of all time.